Possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College, where the Southeast Center at 82nd and Division is now a full-fledged campus, allowing students to earn an associate's degree in their own neighborhood. PCC celebrates on October 18th at noon with campus tours, local food vendors, and live Afro-Cuban music by Maleo de Cuba. pcc.edu/celebrate.
I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Mary Weaver Chapin. She's the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, and she's curated a show called This Is War, Graphic Arts from the Great War. Welcome to KBOO, Mary.
Thank you, Joseph. Glad to be here.
The Great War is World War I, which took place mostly in Northern Europe. Just tell us a little bit about what was going on at that time, why so many pictures appeared.
Well, the Great War, as you say, started in August of 1914, and it was our first World War. We know it better today as World War I, but it was our first truly global conflict. There were eventually 30 countries drawn into this huge conflagration that took place mostly on the Western Front, but also in places far away as Russia, Africa, the Middle East. It was truly a worldwide event. So the artists at the time responded to this with unusual vigor, and I'm hoping this exhibition will show people the wide range of artistic responses. We have artists from 8 different nationalities looking at the conflict, both during the war years, 1914 to 18, and then later reflecting back on their experiences.
Mm-hmm. So I tend to think of this war and the art of, you know, as sort of black and white woodcuts of trench warfare, but you take in a much broader range of media and times of when the art was produced before the war, I think after the war. So just tell us about how you introduce it. You come down the stairs and the first things you see are posters.
Yes, I wanted the first experience for visitors to be sort of a call to arms. You may be able to call to mind recruiting posters, encouraging young men to enlist. But posters were used for a wide range of purposes. Most importantly, perhaps, was to raise money for the war efforts. So that first gallery is full of posters advertising Liberty loans for American fundraising, as well as loans for the Austrians and the French. And you see a lot of different visual languages employed. For instance, this recurring use of symbol as a way to inspire patriotism or as a way to vilify the enemy. For example, one of my favorite posters in that room is a beautiful lithograph of a double-headed eagle. And it is a war loan poster done by an Austrian artist that shows this national symbol, the double-headed eagle, clutching a sword in his talons. Now, it's very interesting. If you step back across the room, you can see that same symbol used by a French artist. And in that case, it's a French soldier strangling the eagle. So you get this repetition of symbols used by artists on different sides of the conflict.
Is the strangled one double-headed?
I think he just has one eagle, but everyone would have known immediately what they are referring to.
Right. And the eagle shows up. There's a great one, Keep These Off Our Land. And it's a pair of cowboy boots covered in blood with spurs, and they have that eagle on them.
Yes, it's a really wonderfully graphic statement. I joke to visitors that it's the visual precursor to Don't Mess with Texas, because you have this powerful pair of riding boots soaked in blood. You don't see anything else, but you can identify the boots as Austrian or German from this eagle, mm-hmm. this majestic eagle on them.
The text actually says, keep these off the USA, buy more Liberty Bonds. So this is an American poster, and obviously at that point they thought there was a chance of invasion.
Yes, it's interesting how this language of fear helps spur action among the civilians. as we know now, they didn't come anywhere close to having fighting on the United States soil, but just the suggestion was enough to inspire people to give to Liberty Bonds.
Mm-hmm. And these works are very, you know, they're posters, they're multicolored, big, they're very impressive. Where do they come from?
The posters in the first gallery come from two sources. Daniel Bergsvik and Donald Hassler have very generously loaned from their private collection, and you see a number of their posters in the room, but there are also works from our own collection, and they have sort of an interesting history. They were given to the museum in 1920 by a certain Mr. William Lewis Brewster Jr., and as far as I can tell, they have never been exhibited. In fact, they were not, they were accessioned into the collection, but they hadn't been cataloged, identified, measured, or photographed until this spring when we brought them all out into our workroom and I was able to go through every single one of them. And now we know that we have about 90 World War I posters that mm-hmm. came in right at that moment when the war was ending.
Do you have any sense of how Brewster got hold of them?
I do not know how Brewster obtained them. They're all American, and they clearly were never posted. They are in pretty good shape. They're mm-hmm. a little bit rough around the edges, but if they had been posted in banks or on billboards, they would have certainly have deteriorated. So there's a story there, but I haven't been able to uncover it yet.
And as part of, you're the curator of graphic art, so that's the kind of thing you get to do. You look through the stacks and find things that haven't been touched for a long time.
That's right. We have a very large collection at the Portland Art Museum, and it takes a new curator years and years to lay her eyes on every single object in the collection. And those can be some of my most exciting moments when mm-hmm. I come across things I wasn't aware we had or things that hadn't been fully cataloged yet. And when I can offer more information to our viewers, either in an exhibition or through our online collections.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So some of these have been scanned and put online?
Absolutely. Everything in the exhibition from our collection is online. But if visitors wanted to go and do a keyword search like World War I or poster, they would see many more things mm-hmm. that didn't quite fit in this exhibition.
Oh, wow. And the posters have been very popular, you say. Visitors kind of gravitate towards them?
Yes, they respond instantly. And I think that's because the posters are really designed to communicate in a quick way. They have bold graphics, very clear language, and they trade in simple symbols that people understand. And some of those symbols are very ugly, like how do you vilify the enemy in order to consolidate public support at home? And so in some of the American posters, you see the German soldiers depicted as animals or barbarians, or in one statement, Huns. They say, beat back the Hun with Liberty Bonds. So those can be a little bit uncomfortable looking at it today, how we caricatured the enemy.
Mm-hmm. The exhibition then develops into sort of trench warfare. You know, what's going on in the battlefield? And what are some of the standout pieces there?
As we move into the trench warfare, I think artists are able to provide a sensation not of just the physical reality of the trench, the landscape of battle, but also the psychological component. And perhaps Otto Dix is the most accomplished in that arena. He did a breathtaking suite of prints entitled simply The War, published in 1924. In which he captured the action of the battle as well as the boredom, the torment, the terror of all of the life of the average soldier. So some of these images are very difficult to look at, but I hope the viewer will spend some time with them because Dix is also one of the most accomplished etchers in the exhibition. He just has an astounding ability with the etching needle and the acid baths.
Mm-hmm. And he was also went on to be a well-known painter. There are a lot of very black and white, stark images in this. Is that because of the technology of the day, or is that how they were responding to the war?
That's a great question, because by this time, artists certainly could have chosen to work in color etching. Color lithography was another option. Woodblock prints can use color. But I think you're right. I think they felt that this stark language of black and white was somehow more appropriate in conveying the experience of the war. And so there are some passages in the exhibition where you will see very tonal prints, just using blacks, whites, and grays. And then there are moments when, with some wonderful color, jump out at you. But I think the black and white also better captured a sort of a psychological framework of anxiety and anticipation in these prints.
Mm-hmm. There's a very startling picture just called Barbed Wire by a French artist, Valentin.
Yes, there is a suite of woodblock prints by Félix Vallotton, and the title of the suite is C'est la guerre, this is war, and that's where the exhibition title comes from. And it's a very interesting tension between Vallotton's elegant line and his sophisticated use of black and white and the gruesome reality he depicts. So if you look at this image, Barbed Wire.
So it's part of a series, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So the image is, it looks like a white field with and a black starry sky in the background. But then there's all these lines held with, I guess, posts. So they're the barbed wire. And there are two corpses, quite kind of chubby corpses, you know, caught up in the wire. But it looks almost like a cartoon, like you could see today, like a flash animation or something.
It is interesting. He balances this language of a really simplified, almost cartoony forms with a very elegant line and a gruesome reality. So barbed wire was this very, very deadly component in the war because it was so difficult to cut through. And both sides used it as a defensive measure. But the reality is what would happen is that soldiers would be trying to get through the wire and they'd be picked off by snipers. And it was very difficult to recover the bodies. And so these corpses would remain and become bloated. And in this image, we see these bloated corpses depicted not in a gruesome way at all, but more sort of like puffy cartoon characters. Mm-hmm. And I think that tension in Vallotton between these realities and the sort of elegant depiction makes them really compelling.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that could be from a child's book. You know, it's so kind of simple looking.
Yes, very simple. And if you know Vallotton's work from earlier in the century, he was known for very sophisticated views of Parisian life. So women shopping, or perhaps his best known is a woman reclining on a divan with a little cat. And so there's a real jump in his imagery from the 1890s into the war years.
As the war progressed, the aerial war became, you know, the big thing that everyone was talking about, the new technology, you know, ace pilots. And what did that do to artists? What do you think they saw?
Well, it's important to remember how new the technology of flight was. And I think artists were immediately attracted to the drama and the novelty and the artistic possibilities there. So you see in a wall devoted to aerial flight, we start with a work by Max Beckmann. And you just see the distorted faces of civilians looking to the skies. And it's a good reminder that for the first time, really, in human history, terror could come from above. And you see this sense of panic and anticipation in those faces. And then as you move down the wall, you see some more depictions of the different types of aircraft. Some of them very beautifully rendered. I think there's a sense of awe, too, at the accomplishment and technology. I've noticed that people really respond to the work of Maurice Bousset, who did a series of color lithographs celebrating the great French aces of the war.
Mm-hmm. There's a color print by Maurice Bousset, and it's a red sky with basically two planes that look like they're fighting. You know, it's a Frenchman fighting a Fokker, a German plane. So what is it about that caught people's imaginations?
Well, I think part of the interest is the really acrobatic maneuvers that the pilots had to take in order to engage the enemy and then evade him. Machine guns were mounted to the front of the plane. So to attack, you had to fly straight at your enemy. And then to get away, you had to do dramatic twists and turns, sometimes causing the engines to cut out. So in the image you're referencing, it's unclear whether one plane, which appears to be spiraling down, has it been shot or has it just delivered a shot and is now in an evasive maneuver? So artists really capitalize on the inherent drama in the skies to depict this new type of warfare and also to celebrate the young men from their countries who were fighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting how artists pick up on, you know, the new imagery from war. So, you know, the first Gulf War was that idea of a bomb that could go straight down a chimney, and it produces fuzzy gray image of a chimney that suddenly explodes. And it wasn't much to look at, but it was shown over and over again, and it sort of defined the way that war was fought. And I think now we're just obsessed with drones, but they don't really produce much imagery. It's like you're either looking at something trundling along the ground, or you're looking at something that suddenly blows up out of nowhere. It's strange. There isn't that drama of, you know, things moving or people's faces upturned.
No, it's very interesting, too. You'll notice that the planes are all very carefully described. And so I think an observer at the time would be able to pick out immediately, you know, those are the French planes. Those are the Dutch design planes used by the Germans. And there's a real specificity here, I think, that betrays that interest in this new technology.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Mary Weaver Chapin. She's the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. She's here talking about her show, This Is War, Graphic Arts from the Great War, and that runs through December the 14th. There's a section called Dance of Death, or what's going on when war produces these really macabre images?
During my research for the show, one of the things I kept coming across was this recurrent motif of a dance of death. And what I found so interesting is that this is a very, very old tradition dating back to medieval times, probably first appearing in German literature and art as a Totentanz, dance of death. But you see it in other cultures as well. And the dance of death is usually depicted as skeletons or some other personification of death accompanying the living. And during times of stress and turmoil, this motif tends to reoccur. So it's not surprising that during World War I, you see artists returning to this. And so in this section, we have French, German, an Austrian, and a British artist all reviving this tradition of personifying death to give shape to this overwhelming presence that they all feel, both on the home front and in battle.
Mm-hmm. And there's one image, a skeleton just standing in someone's living room overlooking. It looks like a man and his son.
Yes.
Someone's coming or going.
It's a very moving image by Georges Rouault entitled, Father, This Shall Be the Last Time. So he's taking leave of his father, and then this ghastly image of death is waiting to escort the young soldier to the battlefields. And you see this a repetition of death as a skeleton, or in one case, as a war fury calling people into action. One of my favorite prints in this section is by a British artist named Percy Smith. And legend has it that he had copper plates smuggled to him wrapped inside of war newspapers in the trenches so he could actually start working on his imagery while he was fighting. Now, I think there might be some problems with that theory because you need a lot of equipment to do etchings, equipment you certainly wouldn't have in the trenches. But his work really is very stirring. He too worked in a series entitled Dance of Death, A Modern Dance of Death, 1914 to 1918. And we have two plates. One is simply entitled Death Waits, and you see a figure of death waiting at a battlefield. The second image we have is entitled Death Refuses. And in that case, soldiers who are suffering are reaching out towards death for deliverance, and instead death turns his back on them.
Mm. Did he make it home?
Yes, Percy Smith did survive the war and had a long career, but not well known to American audiences. So it's exciting to present some of these artists who have not been seen in the Portland Art Museum mm-hmm. for the first time.
What was he known as in his later career? Was he a painter, or he stayed as an illustrator?
He was more of an illustrator and a calligrapher of all things.
Oh.
Yes. Something of a surprise. But those come from a wonderful collection in Washington State. Tom and Lori Furman have been very generous with loans. So as you go through the show, you'll recognize that name again and again. We're very grateful for their generosity.
The a lot of the imagery from war always seems to be pacifist in a sense. It's showing how bad war is, and the message seems to be we shouldn't be doing this. Is that true, or is it just people reflecting what they saw?
I think there are both examples in the war. It's important to read the labels as you go through and figure out when things were made. So we have objects that were made during the height of the war, and then things that were made much later as artists look back and reflect. After the war, it was a lot easier to show some of these gruesome realities. There were less censorship, and artists felt freer to depict what they recalled from their experience. In some cases, these were done much, much later as artists saw the approaching Second World War coming, and they tried to warn each other and the world about the horrors of World War I. So some of the later work in the show was done as late as the late 1930s.
Mm-hmm. I know it's hard to generalize about Europe, but do you think censorship was pretty routine during the war, that a gallery would not show atrocities from a ongoing war?
Yes, that I think that is quite true, that there was a lot of censorship, both by the government and self-censorship, too, by the populace who was trying to support the war effort. But there are notable exceptions of galleries that showed more of the gruesome face of the war than others. So I think there was this undercurrent throughout the war that you would be able to see. But it's also a question of how much of an appetite did the viewing public have for that.
Mm-hmm. There's a whole section about the home front, which is propaganda about, you know, who's left at home and what they should be doing. Tell us about some of those pieces, because some of them are quite amusing.
As we move into the section about the home front, it's a transition between the horrors of war and propaganda on how to mobilize resources at home. So viewers will probably first come across the work of Ketta Kollwitz, who was a remarkable graphic artist and created a series of woodcuts simply entitled Seven Woodcuts About the War. We display two. One of the very powerful images of a mother left at home, a woman left at home, and she protectively guards a young child with this powerful hand. And Kollwitz was perhaps the best artist at depicting the grief and the loneliness and the hunger of Germans back on the home front who suffered greatly. And her work is so powerful that I think it remains one of the best graphic statements from this time.
This is a woodcut, and everything in it is black except the highlights of the face and the hands and the very wrinkled faces and weathered, and even the child's head is very just a stark white blob. So this was done, this was the home front, but this was an unromanticized look of the home front.
Absolutely. When war first broke out, Kollwitz, like many of her generation, saw it as an unfortunate but necessary evil. And her son, Peter, volunteered right away. Well, Peter was killed within months, and she was deeply stricken with grief and tried to work through her art to present a message about the realities of war. The other woodcut we have by Kollwitz in that section is entitled The Volunteers, and you see the figure of death beating a war drum and dragging five young men behind him into war. And one of those young men is a portrait of her son, Peter. So very, very, very powerful work. And I think holds its own a century later.
Mm-hmm. One of the other home front images is a poster from the U.S. Food Administration telling people what to eat. So it's eat more corn, oats, rye, fish. And it's this bizarre, like, you know, it's kind of like the food pyramid, but when you read what you shouldn't eat, less wheat, fat, and then it says save it for the army.
All the combatant nations faced food shortages at home, and so the governments encouraged their civilians to save meat and sugar and wine, important things for the armies. And you see this with the Germans, the French, the Americans, encouraging people also to plant victory gardens, small cottage gardens that they could use to take pressure off the agricultural system. Now, hanging beside the American version is a small French poster in which three little school children are gazing up at a sweet shop. They're looking at candy and confections inside a shop. And the caption reads, "We will know how to sacrifice, or we will manage to do without." And so it shows you how even children were being called upon to do their part for the war effort.
There's another one called Salvation Army Lassie.
That has been affectionately dubbed as the Donut Girl among staff at work. And it's an image of a young woman holding a plate of donuts and an American soldier with a mile-wide grin. And it's sort of a humorous look at a very real situation, which was that thousands and thousands of women volunteered in support positions like Salvation Army and the YWCA to help morale and to support the troops. Now, one of these young women came up with the idea of frying bits of dough to give the soldiers a reminder of home comforts. And on that very first day that she did so, she fried up 150 donuts. Now, they became so popular that they expanded their operation, and soon 9,000 donuts a day were being served to American soldiers. Now, a funny sort of history about that is that American soldiers came back to the United States with a real hankering for donuts. And so it led to an explosion in the popularity of donuts following World War I.
So the show is called This Is War, and it runs through December the 14th. Is the show part of a broader look at World War I?
This anniversary year of World War I has inspired many institutions to take a look at the war. Not only art museums, but historical institutions and archives. And we are part of a worldwide dialogue reflecting on World War I, the Great War, and its impact. So if people are interested, you can find information with great websites put out by the BBC, PBS, and a host of other museums who are examining the visual arts of the World War.
The Portland Art Museum's online efforts have improved a lot recently. So how much of this is available if you can't get to the museum?
Well, visitors to our website would be able to see all the works that we own that are in the collection online. There are a number of loans, and those aren't pictured on our website. But you can also dig even further by searching through our component known as online collections. And you can see the 90 World War I posters we have. You can see work by these same artists in greater depth, and it's really a great tool to explore and expand your understanding.
And you've been the curator of graphic arts since 2012, so part of your job is going through the stacks and finding new things and things that haven't been seen for a while. So what are you doing now? You know, now this is up and running, what are you preparing for the future?
I'm looking forward to doing an exhibition on recent acquisitions to show people some of the great collecting that's been going on at the Portland Art Museum. And I'm preparing for a big print fair in January 2015, which is a chance to buy museum quality prints from top dealers from across the United States and Europe. So we held our first one last year in January, and we're very proud to return to that this year and give people a chance to buy and browse.
That's hosted by the museum?
It's hosted by the museum and will be held in our beautiful Fields Ballroom.
When will that be?
That opens on January 30th and runs through February 1st.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week was Mary Weaver Chapin. She's the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. She was talking about the show This Is War, Graphic Arts from the Great War, which runs through December the 14th. Thank you very much for coming into KBOO, Mary.
Thank you, Joseph.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to support More Love for Linda, a tribute and celebration of life for Linda Hornbuckle, who passed away Saturday, October 4th. A benefit concert was already planned to help raise funds for her medical bills, and now will raise funds for the family debt and serve as a public tribute and celebration of Linda's life. More Love for Linda will be held Tuesday, October 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Crystal Ballroom, and will feature Quarterflash, Soul Vaccination, the Linda Hornbuckle Band, and other special guests. Again, that's Tuesday, October 14th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Amazing grace.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland performance of Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. Carla Lara, Honduran jazz singer, songwriter, and political activist, will be performing at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. She is a working artist, journalist, and feminist in a country where resistance in her artistic life has always been tied to political life in Central America. That's Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Tuesday, October 14th, 2014. In local news, the Milagro Theater Company in Southeast Portland has rejected a touring performance of the play My Name is Rachel Corey, claiming that the play is anti-Semitic. My Name is Rachel Corey features the writings of a 23-year-old student from Olympia, Washington, who was killed in 2003 while engaged in a nonviolent protest in Gaza, trying to stop a Palestinian home from being bulldozed by Israeli soldiers. The creators of the play say they've faced the charge of anti-Semitism before when they tried to produce the play in an off-Broadway performance in New York.